Yesterday, we started talking about what happens with a Hamiltonian system when there is gauge symmetry around. And starting from the Lagrangian formulation, I showed you that what happens is that certain algebraic equations arise when one tries to perform a Legendre transformation. The Legendre transformation cannot really be performed because it turns out to be singular. If the original Lagrangian was singular, and that tends to be related exactly to the presence of gauge symmetry. Formally, the subclass of systems we are interested in, just to recap a little bit from yesterday, is what I called first-class constraint systems. And it was characterized, so I have a bunch of equations that define a submanifold of phase space with A running from 1 to M. So this is all stuff you should have already written down. And now, specifically, what I require is that they Poisson commute on the constraint surface, so that the right-hand side of these Poisson brackets is zero, is weakly zero. And that was defined as zero on the constraint surface. And what it means, in these in finite dimensions at least, that if it vanishes weakly, it can actually be written as a linear combination of those constraints. So it goes both ways. And I also required that I had a condition on the dynamics in the shape of the Hamiltonian. This should also vanish weakly on the constraint surface. So everything Poisson commutes on this constraint surface. What does that mean? It means really that I can choose, if I want to, locally on the constraint surface coordinates such that these become, say, all momenta. Because that's what we know. I mean, if we are sitting just on an R2N, commuting, totally commutative subalgebras are, for instance, well, any bunch of PIs. They Poisson commute with each other, or any bunch of QIs, or of course, a suitably chosen mixture of Qs and Ps so that no index appears twice. But so one also says they're in involution. And of course, it has something to do with the integrabilities of the associated flow lines. And this here, well, we looked at, one can think of in various geometric ways. One can think of, well, the Hamiltonian doesn't change in the directions of these of the gauge transformations generated by this phi A, or conversely, the value of these phis doesn't change under time evolution. So, and again, that was kind of that was a self-consistency solution in order that really the dynamics can be confined consistently to this surface. Okay, and then what we also saw is that now this is kind of specific for these first-class constraints. So first-class constraints, I use this expression, strike twice. And by this I mean, for each one of those constraints, you can effectively subtract two dimensions from your phase space. So there are two unphysical dimensions they correspond to. So strike one is, of course, if I have a bunch of M of those, they constrain me to a subspace, which I call the constraint surface, and I call this SC. And the dimension of this space was 2n minus m. So I subtract exactly one dimension for each of the constraints. And they were supposed to be independent. But secondly, we also saw, once we are now on SC, is that the action kind of generated by these phis foliates this subspace SC into so-called gauge orbits. So they induce, the constraints induce a foliation of the subspace into gauge orbits. Into gauge orbits, and each of these is of dimension n, m. And this led to this picture I drew yesterday. So schematically, I'm starting here from kind of the big phase space. Then I reduce myself to some constrained surface inside that. And on the constrained surface, I have the gauge orbits. And I'm keen to, well, either make a gauge choice or just look at the space of orbits where each orbit is corresponds to one point of the physical phase space. So that was captured by saying, sorry, where should I write this? So the physical phase space is this SC divided by, or looking, well, with respect to the equivalence relation, that two points are to be considered as equivalent if they lie along the same orbit. So that was a picture we are already familiar with from looking at what gauge transformations do in the Lagrangian formalism. Okay, and of course the dimension of this physical phase space was 2n minus 2m. Now one can contrast this with another type of constrained systems which obeys this condition but not that condition. So what does it mean not to obey that condition? It just means on the right-hand side, well, other stuff can appear. For example, constants can appear, right? What this means is that, well, I cannot consider all of those as kind of momentum direction, but I have some mixture of momentum. And if I look at it in local Dabu coordinates, I have some mixture of momenta and coordinates in such a way that, well, some of them simply do not Poisson commute. And those second class constraints, if you have a pure second class constraint system, then they strike only once. They only reduce you to a subspace, but they don't generate any additional gauge directions on this constraint surface. So that's another type of constraints. And both of these, well, just occur in, you know, in certain field theories you can write down, in certain toy models, field theoretic toy models you can write down. I mean, you find both of these. And really what one has is a whole formalism kind of to reduce oneself, to work out, you know, given a Hamiltonian system, or that's even the more usual case, someone gives you a Lagrangian with a certain, well, functional form, with a certain field content, and you are interested in trying to find out now how big is the physical phase space. And often it's smaller than the entire space of field variables. And then you can just run through an analysis of this kind to systematically find all first and second order constraints, and then do the reduction and then find out, okay, how many physical degrees of freedom are in there. And that's kind of a time-honored way, formalism, and it's due to not just Dirac, but also Bergmann, Peter Bergmann. So both were actually motivated by gravity, but then, well, one can come up with a formalism that is widely applicable and is really widely applied. So it's really a tool in the toolbox of the theoretical physicists to be able to do this kind of constraint, Hamiltonian constraint analysis. So here you just got a glimpse of that. So what are interesting first-class constraint systems? Well, anything that has a gauge symmetry. So you know, say if you take electrodynamics, then of course, you know, it has a local U1 gauge symmetry. And if I insist on analyzing it the Hamiltonian way, I will inevitably find a bunch of constraints. And, well, they actually, so they work exactly like here. They constrain me to a subspace of the field theoretic phase space, and they induce gauge transformations. So, and you have a bunch of explicit constraints in as functions of these fields, in this case, as functions of the photon field, the gauge field. Okay? So it's this is not exotic physics. That is kind of bread and butter physics. The other thing I briefly mentioned was to say I'm often interested in observables of the systems, and that are those quantities that are invariant on the gauge transformations. And in this formalism, that translates to quantities that weakly commute with all the constraints. So H is one example, but there are typically other things you might, I mean, other observables you may wish to study in these constraint systems. Okay, so that was the Dirac, here I have it, Dirac-Bergmann algorithm. So that's really a machine to make a full constraint analysis of a given theory. Okay, so that brings me to the topic of today. So we are straight jumping into the kind of interesting for us application, and that is the canonical formulation, first of all classically, of gravity, of general relativity. So up to now, the examples we've been playing around with, they were really quantum mechanical examples. And although you may not have kind of consciously thought about it at the time, they relied on the presence of a given notion of time. Because already, when I define the canonically conjugate momenta in my Legendre transformation, of course I get them by taking partial derivatives of L with respect to Q dot. And Q dot means differentiation with respect to the notion of time I have. And that would be typically just the Newtonian time in these non-relativistic examples. Now, when we come to GR, there is no longer a distinguished notion of time. But nevertheless, of course, you want to make an analogous treatment like you did in the Hamiltonian formalism for classical mechanics, and it turns out you can do that. But, well, basically there are many ways of doing that. So each choice of time will lead to what one calls a 3+1 split. So each, you know, choice of kind of a global time function will lead to a specific way of formulating any given dynamic, say, of a four-dimensional metric, where I split kind of the four-dimensional covariant fields into three-dimensional quantities, and I can also, just as I did in classical mechanics, introduce conjugate momenta. And the only thing I have to keep in mind is that, well, this initial choice, whatever it was really arbitrary. And that actually plays out in a specific way that these systems then take, where one also finds a bunch of constraints. And one of these constraints actually corresponds to the freedom of reparametrizing time. So we'll then explicitly kind of meet this back in the canonical formalism of general relativity. Okay, so now what we'll first have to do is to introduce a few technical steps which will enable us, you know, given a form metric G mu nu, to write it in a 3+1 split form where, well, which then fits into this canonical picture. Okay, so let my starting data be, again, some differential manifold M and some form metric G mu nu, and let me without much loss of generality. Well, actually no loss for typical classical applications, assume that this M4 can be written as the Cartesian product, so it's topologically the Cartesian product of R. This could also be just an interval in R cross some three-dimensional manifold sigma. And if initially one wants to make one's life easy, one can and often does choose sigma to be a compact manifold. It simply means one doesn't have to deal with boundary conditions, fall-off conditions, and such like. Just for simplicity. Okay, now what one does now is exactly what I said earlier. One chooses a global time function. So the time function has to be such that, you know, it foliates everything into spatial slices, and which of course don't intersect in any way. So I have kind of a one-to-one a mapping between the points of the slice and the ones of the original space. And so this is called a global time foliation. And the function is called a global time function. And let us call this little t. And the condition is that M is foliated by this time function effectively into a set of, well, spatial, it's kind of understood, Cauchy hypersurfaces. What is a hypersurface? In four dimensions, it's just a surface of dimension three. In general, it will be a surface in a general space of codimension one, so of one dimension less than the full space is. A Cauchy surface is one, is every surface which is such that if I give initial conditions on that surface, the time evolution for all, well, positive, negative times is defined. Okay, so that kind of contains all the information I need to know classically in order to understand what my time evolution is. Okay, so there's a little picture that goes with it. So here's my M. And, well, so here I have now a foliation. M is foliated into kind of sheets of constant t. So this is sigma at time t. That is sigma at some later time t prime. So I might just kind of draw a time axis through here. So this is where my time goes. And on each of these, if I want to, I can define a normal vector field to the slides. So at each point, obviously, there is exactly one. I mean, I have already given a metric G mu nu, so I know what it means to be perpendicular, right? And obviously, this vector field will be time-like, right, because it's just pointing that way by necessity. So here's our, so some remarks. So the choice of any t that satisfies this condition is equally good. So a priori one is not making any assumptions that this has any specific physical, is physically distinguished in any way, right? So it's just any t satisfying these conditions. And if you like, you can think of this as a kind of a reference foliation. So it's now some additional structure I introduce, which will enable me to set up now a Hamiltonian framework. But really, in the end, I should remember that what exact foliation I chose was arbitrary. The second remark is that obviously general diffeomorphism, so coordinate transformation, will not map this foliation onto itself. Right? So although clearly you can now define three-dimensional diffeomorphisms that, you know, move, map each slice onto itself, right? In general, a general four-dimensional diffeomorphism will not preserve the structure at all. So again, so we see here, you know, remember like the discussion we had with the Hamiltonian formulation already in the relativistic field theory, kind of breaking manifest Lorentz invariance. Certainly, a choice of such a foliation breaks manifest diffeomorphism invariance. We're not saying it's no longer there, but it will be clearly, one will have to do some work to retrieve it or to impose it in some other way. So this is exactly what happens. So so here, again, my this n, little mu, is a unit normal vector on each sigma t, so it exists at each point, and it's defined, well, it's normalized, so n mu is not plus 1, but minus 1, because it's, of course, a time-like vector. And given this, I can now write down a relation for the three-dimensional metric induced on each hypersurface of this foliation. It's given by, so that's induced three metric on sigma t is h mu nu. So these are still four dimensional indices equal to g mu nu plus eta mu, sorry, n mu n mu in this way. And this, of course, it's trivial to derive from this. If you just multiply this through, say, by n mu index upstairs, n mu that this vanishes. So really, therefore, it just defines a spatial structure that lives in the space perpendicular to this little unit vector n mu. So, and I don't know how far you've progressed in the GR course of Dr. Gregory's, but this is also called the first fundamental form. And at least last year, it was part of her lecture. Was it? Have you already talked about it this year? No? Okay. Anyway, so this is the first fundamental form, which of course means there will be a second fundamental form, which we'll get to in a little bit. So the spatial components of the metric, I like these H's, they will kind of become our spatial coordinates, field coordinates, and these second fundamental forms essentially will become our conjugate momenta. To give you a preview of what's going to happen. So there is a neat way, a standard way, of now re-expressing all components of G mu nu, so not just the spatial ones, the H mu nu's, but also the others, in terms of data that specify the foliation. And that's the so-called ADM, decomposition of the metric. And to explain it, again, I'll draw a picture. So let these be two spatial slices in our foliation associated with times t and t plus dt, some small time interval. Yeah. So what I'm interested in is the physical distance, that means the geodesic distance, between a point on this slice and a point on that slice. So this here has coordinates x, I, and t. And similar, this point upstairs here has coordinates x, I plus dxi, small variation, and of course a t has been also displaced by a small dt. Okay. So now how does the foliation come in? Well, first of all, I had this unit vector that is perpendicular on the slice. And what I'm going to do now here is basically to use slice data to construct this decomposition. And what the slice data know about, first of all, is the distance. I mean, they compare. This is a coordinate, dt. T is just a coordinate. So first of all, I'm interested in, well, how far is this surface away from that surface in terms of geodesic distance or physical distance, right? Because the physical distance I'm interested in is that one here. What I'll be using is kind of basically a version of Pythagoras' theorem in Lorentzian spacetime. So what I do is I now look at I start down here and I draw the straight line that is perpendicular on this surface. So this line is not necessarily perpendicular, but this line by my construction is supposed to be such. And then I have to work out kind of what this distance is. And then, well, ds squared equal this squared plus that squared, with the twist that this will be a minus sign because it's a Lorentzian version and this is a time-like distance. Okay. Now, however, what I have to take also into account is, well, which point up here is called xi, right? So, and it's not, it will not in general be this point. But somehow the way the identification, some arbitrary identification has been made, in general what I have to take into account is that kind of there is a little shift that has taken place. So what, in other words, what is this shift? So first of all, let me start working out by what this is. So we are dealing with an infinitesimal situation. It's linearly related to the dt, and the proportionality constant I call n, or constant at any given point. And this n just quantifies how much d tau, I mean geodesic distance in time direction, is contained in dt, the coordinate delta. Okay? And this is called the lapse. So that is a piece of information you know, you need in order to determine, I claim, this distance here. So this is the ds, this is the nd dt. And as I said, this will be not in general xi, then, but it will be shifted, and the shift xi is, again, I have to quantify this in some way, and it will be proportional to dt, because the more this is all kind of an infinitesimal context in which all these relations are linearized. So this, in general, is some ni times dt. So it will linearly depend, that shift, on how far I've come away from here. And the t is the t plus dt. So what I want to say with this argument is, this is extra information I need, and this is extra information I need. And once I have this, you see, now I really do a Pythagoras theorem. So I compute now the proper distance ds between x mu, which I've split up into t and xi, and x mu plus dx mu, which I split into t plus dt and xi plus dxi. From Pythagoras' theorem. Or I should more properly say a Lorentzian version of it. So ds squared is equal to minus kind of the proper time from sigma t to sigma t plus dt all squared. So it's this, right? And this is just kind of the shortest distance because I've made sure that this is perpendicular on this lower slice. So it, and it picks up a minus sign because of the signature of that direction, plus now the proper distance. The proper distance within the three geometry of the upper slice squared. So it's this piece here. So where's my colored chalk? So this is the yellow stuff. That's here. And this here is the piece up here within the three geometry. How do I work out the proper distance here? Well, I'm given, of course, the coordinate distance in terms of the x and, well, the shifted x and the t. And now I'm using the three-dimensional matrix, the induced metric, in order to work out what the actual geodesic distance is, the true distance, not just the coordinate distance. So let me write it down in terms of all the quantities I now have. So that's, sorry, this is a minus sign. I'm looking now it here, and what this is simply n dt squared, and this n may of course depend on where I am, so it will be generally x dependent squared. So this is just the proper distance between the slices at any given point. And now in order to determine the distance along the spatial directions, I'm using this induced metric, hij. And, well, what is the length of this? It's really, I'm given all the coordinates. It's this minus z all squared. Yeah, so the second piece drops out. What I get here is the dxi plus ni dt dxj plus nj dt. Right, so this is a coordinate differential, and this is makes that this is the geodesic distance. And again, yeah, sorry, I should write this explicitly. These ni's, of course, also may just depend on where I am. So this is to say, yeah, so this information you need, the n's and these ni's, and these are called the lapse functions. And these are called the shift functions. Or the lapse function, it's just a single one. And here I have a kind of a three-component quantity. So now I have achieved what I set out to do. I said I want to re-express all components of G mu nu in terms of data that pertain to my given foliation. So what I found is that I have to specify these lapse and shift functions. So we have now gone effectively, by doing this, from the G mu nu's to hij's, n, and ni. So, of course, if you count those, this was a symmetric 4x4 matrix, 10 entries. This is a symmetric 3x3 matrix, 6 entries. I have one of those. I have 3 of those. Makes also 10. Okay. So 10 degrees of freedom, 6, 1, and 3. And if I want to, I can now rewrite my metric G mu nu as G 0 0, G 0 J, G I 0, G I J, in terms of these new quantities. So here I have just to look at what is multiplying dt squared. I get a contribution from here, a minus n squared, but I also get a contribution from here, from these terms. Okay. So that gives me a nk nk, where here by definition I'm pulling indices up and down with the induced spatial metric, minus n squared. So this is what has become of my G00. And here I have the nj with index downstairs, the ni, and here I have the hij. So this goes by the name of ADM decomposition of the metric. Decomposition. And these are exactly the variables that will now appear in my canonical formalism, primarily. And as one of the exercises this week, small exercises, you invert this metric. So I have already now kind of got closer to a Hamiltonian picture where I just consider things that are given here on a spatial slice, and I consider their evolution with respect to some time. My time is here now called t, But as we've seen, this is largely arbitrary. I'm interested in time development. So what has become of my kind of covariant data is now kind of the evolution in time of kind of the induced metric. And these will now become my kind of the field coordinates. Of course, and it raises the immediate question, what are the analogs of momenta? Or the even more immediate question, what are the velocities? So hij dots, right? So what are those? And the role of those is the velocities is played by another tensor field. It's called capital K, so-called extrinsic curvature. And well, let me write down what it is functionally, and let me then give you a short geometric motivation. So this is my unit normal, one form. This is its covariant derivative with respect to the full metric. And this is essentially a projection onto spatial slices. So what is kind of the geometric situation one has in mind? It has to do, it now explicitly refers to this foliation. And the information I'm interested in is how is it curved, extrinsically curved, with respect to the embedding four-dimensional space. So is it just, you know, flat? Or kind of as I've drawn it here, you know, does it have some curvature? And of course, that will depend on the foliation. I can have a foliation locally that is just, you know, flat slices. But I can have one that is general, and that will be, in general, curved. Now, how do I determine extrinsic curvature? I do it in the following way. So here, of course, everywhere, I still have my orthogonal vector n mu. So I will also have it, say, down here. And one measure of curvature is to compare these vectors at infinitesimally neighboring sites. So, and what I do is I can parallel transport, say, this one back to here. Okay? And of course, parallel transport, right, just means it'll go to here. So that's what the parallel transport does. And then if my embedding, if the slice had been flat, of course it will fall on top of this other one. But in every other case, it will be relatively rotated. And of course, that relative rotation is exactly a measure of how this is extrinsically curved in the ambient space, four-dimensional space. So this is x. This is an x plus dx, infinitesimally far away. So basically, so the difference is what that is the same. I'm making a parallel transport. Basically, it's the same as taking the covariant derivative. So that will just pick out whether this is zero or non-zero and in what direction it points. This is what this does to you. And this here projects things back down onto this manifold. Okay. So you're only interested, yeah, in how, well, how this only in that part of the difference that can be projected along this embedded slice. So this is kind of a parallel transported vector. This is just to, you know, make this plausible to you. I mean, we don't have time to really talk about this and analyze this in greater detail. Yeah. Just to tell you, gives you some ideas that this extrinsic curvature tensor, well, what it measures actually, and when it will be zero, namely when the thing is actually flat. It's a flat slice. So the properties this has by this construction, although they're not immediately obvious, but these things are things one, you know, one shows in a relevant exercise in a GR course, that this is symmetric in the indices, and it's also purely spatial. So K mu mu n mu is equal to zero. So this thing, as I already said, is called the extrinsic curvature. And as I said, it plays the role of really velocity conjugate. Well, not quite conjugate, but well, the velocity of the Hijs. And that can be made slightly more explicit in another little formula. Which I'm just giving you for completeness. Again, it's not a derivation, but a motivation. So what makes kind of the velocity character explicit? So I really have only to take care. I mean, this is purely spatial. So let me just look at the Kijs. Now, the data associated with the foliation appear also here. So this n, the Lebesgue function, appears here. And then, indeed, time derivative of Hij appears. But there are a couple of other terms, di nj, the shift, minus capital Dj ni. This introduces a new notation that is a covariant derivative with respect to the purely spatial metric. This here was a full covariant derivative, four-dimensional, and this here now is the spatial covariant derivative. So what you see here is, if I were in a situation, well, in a, even say in a standard Euclidean situation where kind of x and t were, say, Euclidean coordinates, so directly geodesic, I can directly interpret them in terms of geodesic data, that would mean the n was 1. So no non-trivial scale between the dt and the dtor. And the shifts wouldn't be there, say. You know, I just make some global term. So this term wouldn't be there. Well, I cannot argue the two. I don't kind of argue why. But then you see it's essentially it's just the velocity. It's just Hij dot. But now in the general case, we have these additional dependencies that explicitly refer to the slicing data, the Lebesgue and the shift. OK. Now, what we can do is now we write, I mean, we start with the Lagrangian of general relativity. It depends on the four metric G mu nu and its first and second derivatives. Now, here I have already the decomposition into the n and ni and the Hijs. I just stick this in there, make use of this formula for the extrinsic curvatures, these velocities, and I rewrite my entire Lagrangian with this knowledge. And I just will quote the result for you, because all of these calculations are somewhat involved algebraically, some more, some less. So I'm not able to present the derivation to you. So, but let us just start with the standard Lagrangian in terms of standard variables, covariant variables. Here I have a coupling constant where kappa squared is equal to 16 pi gn, your more familiar Newton constant. So kappa is essentially square root of the Newton constant. And what is this Lagrangian density made up of in for the Einstein-Hilbert case? I get a determinantal term, and then I get the Ricci scalar, the scalar curvature. So integrating that gives me the standard Einstein-Hilbert action without a cosmological term. So my task is now, of course, this and that depend on the GMU's and the derivatives. Now, do we express everything in terms of these slice, these adapted data for the slices, and up to a total derivative, up to a total divergence. So this is what this equality, this Wigley equality sign is supposed to mean. This is given by 1 over kappa squared, n, square root of h, so h, well, I should, to accord with this notation, I should write determinant of hij, which is, of course, now positive and therefore doesn't need a minus sign anymore. Three-dimensional curvature plus kij, kij plus, sorry, minus k, capital K squared. So let me erase this, not to get confused here. Where the K is an abbreviation for the extrinsic curvature with its indices contracted. Okay. So you see, that is kind of step one. This is the Ricci scalar, just of the three-dimensional slices, the intrinsic curvature of the three-dimensional slices. I started out with the intrinsic curvature of the scalar curvature of the four-dimensional space. Now everything is now decomposed into 3D data, which depend on h, plus these velocities, right, the case, the extrinsic curvatures, which know about these ni's and the n, so the lapse and shift data also. One other thing you should notice, that no time derivatives of n and ni appear. So this is just spatial derivatives here, of course. So, and that will also play an important role in what follows. Okay, now I have this Lagrangian given in a convenient form. What means convenient? It's now in a form where I can make a Legendre transformation, because now I've identified essentially what my velocities are. So what I do now, I define momenta for all of my 10 dynamical variables, conjugate momenta. So I had the n's, the ni's, and then the hij's. So for all of those, in principle, I'm now looking for what are the conjugate momenta. I start with the conjugate momentum associated with one component of this vector n. So let me now define n mu as n ni, lapse and shift. Let me put this together in a four, into a four vector. Let now p mu be the associated momentum obtained as usual by taking out a partial functional derivative of the Lagrangian density with respect to the velocity. So it's just n mu dot. And, of course, what I just pointed out to you, no time derivatives of these n's appear. So this is actually zero. Now, secondly, I'm interested now in the conjugate variables. They will be a little more interesting. Of the hijs, and these are completely analogously given in terms of the partial derivatives of the Lagrange density with respect to hij dot. And, well, this is an easy function that I have isolated in these kijs already. So what this gives me is a 1 over kappa squared, square root of determinant of h, kij minus khij. And of course, yes, the indices should be downstairs. So I'm just kind of blindly applying my scheme for doing the Legendre transformation. Of course, now I have these many fields floating around, so it's a little bit complicated algebraically, but not in principle. Okay. So here we are seeing that, well, these kijs are essentially, they're closely related to the momenta, the conjugate momenta. So immediately I can write down canonical Poisson brackets. Let me only write down the ones that do not vanish. And now I'm in a field theory. Now, I have to specify that I work within a given spatial slice when I define these Poisson brackets. So these are the kind of the equal time Poisson brackets. So what are these? Well, very simply, the n mu x Poisson bracket with p nu y at equal time, so x naught equal to y naught, is delta function, del mu nu, and a three-dimensional delta function, Dirac delta function. Okay, so that is just the symplectic structure, the canonical Poisson bracket structure I've now isolated. And similarly, hij of x, pkl of y, has equal time commutators, the Poisson brackets, excuse me, which are also delta function, but now I have to pay attention, these are symmetric tensors, so that will be reflected in the tensor structure of the right-hand side, delta ik, delta jl, plus delta il, delta jk, times three-dimensional Dirac delta function. And very lastly, let me write down now the action, kind of in canonical form, using already these variables. It looks like the following. It just depends now on these conjugate pairs, hij, pij, n and n I, because of course the conjugate momenta are zero, so they do not appear. And it's like, it looks like this. It's a four-dimensional integral I split into a time interval integral and a spatial integral, and pi I j h I j dot minus n h perp minus n I h I. So just to, you know, we talk about, you know, there's a contents of this expression tomorrow. But really, I just want to emphasize, I have done kind of steps that are in principle trivial, well, trivial apart from the algebra involved. It's just a Legendre transformation. I rewrite my L in a form that is PQ dot minus rest. And of course, the rest is the Hamiltonian of the system, right? So, and exactly, so this final expression, although I haven't told you what these functions here are, this is just the rewritten in a form where I can directly read off what the Hamiltonian of the system is, because here is the PQ dot, and this is the minus rest, and so this must be my Hamiltonian. And the derivatives of those don't appear because, well, we see there will be constraints floating around because we already know, of course, that the system has a gauge symmetry. So we know that it is a first-class constraint system, so I do expect non-trivial phase-space relations appearing. And what these are precisely and what they mean, we'll talk about next time. Yes? Yeah. You mean when I rewrite this?
That's equality.
Yeah.
R4 equals that R3 plus that terms with extrinsic.
Yeah, this here, yes.
Isn't that also term that's R4, like alpha beta contracted with mu alpha n alpha n beta? Like,
this
what
R
does that equality mean total divergence?
Yeah, this is an equality where I've at most thrown away total divergences. Okay, so and this is a correct. Yeah, I'm not. I cannot now pinpoint exactly, you know, what your issue is. Yeah, but this. Well, this is what it is. Essentially, yeah. Again, it's some massaging. I mean, in algebra, this is not completely trivial to compute with. So one needs also a little bit of practice. It's not really what we have much time, you know, practicing in this course because we are, of course, we're still headed towards the quantum theory. So this is kind of the classical warm-up to make you understand, look, this is now what we want to quantize. And of course, it's unfamiliar and unknown to you at this classical level. So you have to absorb, of course, quite a bit of stuff and also have to take, you know, many of these things at face value. Now, this is what they are. I invite you, you know, to just try and reproduce, just to see what is the algebraic level of difficulty, you know, try and reproduce some of these relations. Okay, good. That's as far as you're getting today, and I see you again tomorrow. Thank you.